Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. For nearly 25 years, Bob Edwards was the morning voice of National Public Radio. On April 30th, that ended. Now Edwards is out with a new book on American broadcast journalism's great pioneer and standard setter, Edward R. Murrow. Tonight on Point, we'll talk with Bob Edwards about Murrow, about NPR, and about the state of broadcast news. But first, in Jerusalem, Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon fired two far-right cabinet ministers today in anticipation of a Sunday vote on his controversial plan for a unilateral withdrawal of Israeli settlements from Gaza. The ministers tried to dodge Sharon's couriers carrying dismissal papers, reportedly to delay the vote. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. I asked him whether ministers Avigdor Lieberman and Benjamin Elon had been tracked down.
Well, one of them got the dismissal papers while he was at the gym. He said he was too busy to go and see the prime minister, but he was at the gym when he was found. So they were delivered to him. The other minister, Benny Elon, who's the tourism minister, is apparently down in Netzarim, which is one of the settlements in the Gaza Strip that is supposed to be evacuated. So they didn't manage to locate him in time, and it's now the Jewish Sabbath, so I think the hunt will probably be off, at least until that's over on Saturday evening.
Now, Harvey, as we understand, these dismissal papers take effect 48 hours after they're served. Prime Minister Sharon wanted to have a vote on this on Sunday. Does this mean he's been stymied by the cabinet minister hiding out in Gaza Strip?
Well, I suppose it might mean that. It's got a bit of a Keystone Cops feel to it, the whole affair. I suppose Benny Elon is trying to make a point. I don't think at the end of the day it will really change very much because Sharon has said that he's not going to allow Lieberman or Elon to attend a meeting and they're not going to be allowed to vote in any vote that he may call. On the other hand, they may present some legal challenge to that, in which case I suppose the vote would be put off for a day or so.
And yet, for all the shenanigans here, the stakes are very high, both for Israel, its settlements, and potentially even for the Sharon government. If he succeeds in dismissing these cabinet members and pushes through a vote in his cabinet to withdraw from Gaza, might it put his ruling coalition at stake? Might Sharon's government fall?
Well, it might well do. The interesting thing is that the two people he's fired are not in his Likud party. They're in a much more right-wing party, which is part of the coalition. The main problem he faces is within his own party because there are 13 members of Likud in the cabinet. And while five, including him, support the plan, eight oppose it. And that is not going to change. Even if he wins the vote in cabinet, those eight ministers are still expected to vote against it.
But we understood that as things stood before these dismissals, he had a kind of a 12-11 opposition to a Gaza pullout. If he gets rid of two, doesn't that give him a majority, a squeaker, but a majority?
It gives him a majority, but it doesn't change the fact that eight ministers of his own party will have voted against his plan. So that has implications for where the party goes. Now, it's conceivable that the people who are leading this rebellion, although they don't like the word, and the chief among them is Benjamin Netanyahu, the finance minister, they may try to attempt some challenge against him in the parliament, where he has a very narrow majority as well, 61-60. And if they had enough dissidents on their side, I suppose that they could try and attack him there rather than in the cabinet. He would then have to fall back on the support of the Labour Party, which is in opposition at the moment.
Harvey Morris, remind us of what Ariel Sharon is attempting to do here, large scale.
fundamentally, he wants to carry out the plan that he put to President Bush on April 14, and that is to evacuate all the Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip and four more small settlements in the West Bank. Now, the only concession he's made to his opponents is to say that that would be staged over a period of months rather than be carried out in one fell swoop. However, he told the parliament the other day, a parliamentary committee, that all Jews in the Gaza Strip would have left by the end of 2005. So he's very much nailed his colours to the mast there, largely, or certainly in part, in response to pressure from the Bush administration.
Palestinians have been loud critics of this, saying it's a unilateral solution that has not consulted them. What's the rationale that Ariel Sharon has given to Israelis for this step?
He really doesn't have to justify it too much in the minds of the general population, because every opinion poll that comes out says that they're on his side. The latest poll today showed that 59% of the electorate are in favor of a unilateral withdrawal. So that would imply that, you know, if things went to an election, he would probably get a powerful majority in favor of withdrawal. What that would mean, you know, in party terms is hard to say, because half of his party is against withdrawal.
This move would take 7,500 settlers out of Gaza. There remain 230,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. How many of those would be withdrawn under the Sharon plan? And are the Palestinians likely to accept the remainder, whatever that may be?
Literally a handful. We're talking about four small settlements, one of which I'd passed by it a couple of weeks ago, and there was no signs of life at all. So we're talking about a very small number of settlements in the West Bank that will be withdrawn. The idea is to open up the northern West Bank somewhat and allow more freedom of Palestinian movement. But we're not talking about removing tens of thousands of settlers from the West Bank at the moment, although the Palestinians certainly hope, and I think the international community assumes, that there will be much greater withdrawals in the West Bank in future.
But if there are not, is this a settlement that the Palestinians could live with, or are we just going to see more resistance?
I think there will be resistance, whether it continues to be a military resistance or whether it becomes a political one is difficult to tell. But, of course, all this is being done over their heads. They've not been consulted about it. They would like to get involved in the Gaza withdrawal. As for the West Bank, it's so small scale as really not to be anywhere near what they're asking for.
So if the remaining cabinet minister can be tracked down in Gaza and the dismissal papers served, maybe a vote on Sunday or soon after, and maybe some dramatic action on Gaza. Harvey Morris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. From London rooftops with German bombers blitzing the city, CBS radio reporter Edward R. Murrow held America riveted with his live reports of World War II unfolding and his crackling dateline, "This is London." From his wartime reports through the Marshall Plan, the Berlin Airlift, McCarthyism, and the Cold War, Edward R. Murrow set a standard that would become the standard against which American broadcast journalism would be measured. Our guest tonight, NPR's Bob Edwards, a radio icon in his own right, says that measure is humbling today. Just a month ago, Edwards left his longtime post as host of NPR's Morning Edition. Tonight on Point, we'll ask him about his new book on Edward R. Murrow, The State of Broadcast News and the State of NPR. Do you remember Edward R. Murrow's famous voice cutting across the airwaves? Are you making it out of bed these days without Bob Edwards' morning greeting? What's your take on the state of the news? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Tucson, Arizona, is Bob Edwards, host of National Public Radio's Morning Edition from its beginnings in November 1979 until April 30th this year. His new book is Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. Good evening and welcome, Bob Edwards.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. Wonderful to have you with us. There's so much we want to hear from you tonight, but first of all, how is it not getting out of bed at 1 in the morning?
Pretty nice. I could get used to that, I think.
Have you changed your entire life rhythm, or are you still in the process of of turning around, Bob?
No, it's going this way is an easy adjustment. It's going the other direction that takes some getting used to.
We want to hear a lot about your departure from NPR and your plans for the future, your view of public radio broadcast journalism. But we want to get a big helping of Ed Murrow tonight. You've got the new book. It's terrific. We're going to hear some sound from Ed Murrow. But I wish you'd tell us first, Bob Edwards, this is such a giant in broadcast journalism. You're a lifelong radio newsman. What does Edward R. Murrow mean to you? Is he a hero, a model, a mythic figure, something more human than that? How do you see him?
Well, he's quite human, and I like my heroes human, but a hero is, setting the highest standard for what constitutes news and for how that news should be covered, and setting it very early, because I think more than anyone else, he's responsible for making broadcasting, both radio and television, media for news.
I wish you'd paint a picture for us, because, of course, many people have no idea of what radio was before the Edward R. Murrow impact on it, what it became under his influence.
Well, what you heard of news was event-driven. They covered events. The Scopes trial was very big on radio. The Lindbergh trial was very big on radio. Political conventions, speeches, press conferences, and the like. And these were covered mostly by announcers. You had commentaries from the likes of H.V. Kaltenborn, people who had been newspaper columnists turned radio commentators. What you didn't have was a lot of original enterprise reporting, reporters going out and digging up stories, mm-hmm. and original stuff. And Murrow changed that. Actually, it's World War II that changed it. And
and the run-up to that war when he set up a network right across Europe to talk about it.
That's right. He saw the war coming, and he needed some help. He had no news background at all. Himself, and he hired William L. Shirer, who had been a veteran newspaper and wire service reporter. And suddenly, Hitler annexed Austria in the spring of 1938, and these two guys who were not supposed to go on the air themselves did so. They were kind of pressed into service because of the emergency, and William Paley, the founding chairman of CBS, liked it so much, he says, let's do another one tomorrow.
Bob Edwards.
What you had there was the nightly roundup, they called it. We would just know it as a newscast.
Right, and on it came, and including live real-time radio reporting. Let's get just a little taste of Ed Murrow, Bob Edwards, here in his first live radio rooftop broadcast from London during the September 21st, 1940 German air raid on the city.
The plane is still very high, and it's quite clear that he's not coming in for his bombing run. Earlier this evening, we could hear occasionally, again, those were explosions overhead. Earlier this evening, we heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away. Just overhead now, the burst of the anti-aircraft fire. Still, the nearby guns are not working, and the searchlights now are feeling almost directly overhead. Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
Edward R. Murrow, September 21st, 1940, during the German Blitz on London. And Bob Edwards, there it is, not just an evening news roundup, but live coverage that we've come to think of as ordinary, but not at all ordinary in 1940.
Well, that's right. If people had heard the actual sounds of war before, it had been because they had been in one themselves. Most Americans had never heard that. And to have that going on in your living room, it made, I'm sure, quite an impression on people. And that's what Murrow was doing, telling them what England was going through.
This was a whole new face of radio. We're going to talk a lot about tonight about radio and the state of broadcasting then and now with Bob Edwards, longtime host of NPR's Morning Edition, left that position on April 30th of this year. He's out with a new book, Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. You can join our conversation tonight. What's your question for the host of NPR's Morning Edition for 24 years and 6 months, Bob Edwards? Where do you hear the spirit of Edward R. Murrow moving in American journalism today? Do you hear it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob Edwards, stand by. It's great to have you tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Bob Edwards about broadcast news legend Edward R. Murrow, and with Bob Edwards about Bob Edwards and NPR. His new book is Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. You can join our conversation tonight. What's the difference between Edward R. Murrow on a London rooftop in the Blitz and an American broadcaster reporting today from Baghdad? Is there a difference? Are you tired of hearing about Murrow's golden age of American journalism, or do we need to hear this now more than ever? And how are your mornings going with Bob Edwards, without Bob Edwards, taking you into the day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob Edwards, when you look at Edward R. Murrow's career and the famed standards that he set, how do you define them? What are they?
He went by what the better newspapers were doing. That was his standard. And there were more newspapers in 1938 when he started in radio. And they were better. So that's what he brought to radio, a standard that that any newspaper, any fine newspaper, would be proud of. And he surrounded himself with some very, very bright and young reporters, building the team. He was a terrific talent scout. He mm-hmm. had Howard K. Smith and Charles Collingwood, who had been Rhodes Scholars, Winston Burdett, who finished Harvard in 3 years, magna cum laude. He hired smart people with contacts. He didn't care about pretty voices. His bosses in New York cared about pretty voices, didn't like the ones he hired. For him, that was all the more reason to hire them.
And give us a sense of the personality, Bob, the character behind the broadcaster. Who was Edward R. Murrow off microphone?
He was a champion of the underdog. He was a working class kid out of, he was born in Polecat Creek, North Carolina. Mm. But when he was five, the family moved to the state of Washington, and he was really raised in the timber camps of the state of Washington, and had been very active in so many areas in high school and college. Every conceivable kind of extracurricular activity, he was in it, and usually its leader. He was the classic big man on campus, the guy who was driven to go somewhere. On fire, it seemed.
And as a broadcaster, or as and beyond, a big smoker, smoking even on air when talking about the dangers of cigarettes, you write, Bob Edwards.
Well, a lot of people did that. There wasn't that prohibition on smoking in those days. A lot of people did. I remember, I can still see Mike Wallace doing cigarette commercials.
That's right.
For Parliament.
And Ed Murrow, and this amazed me, just nervous as could be right up until the time of a broadcast. Even a shot of whiskey coming in there to calm the nerves at airtime.
Yeah, he had Mike Fright, the guy who could stand under bombs and report on the war, the guy who could fly combat missions, 15 in World War II and another 10 in Korea, with the searchlights right on his plane, and they're taking evasive action to get out of that light. And he has Mike Fright. I don't understand it. He had the guts to take on Joe McCarthy, but he had Mike Fry.
It's amazing. What was it that ultimately led to Edward R. Murrow's falling out, first of all, with his early great comrade, William Shire, and later, famously, with CBS itself?
Shire is a difficult call, and I didn't make any judgment there. I just kind of quoted what Shire said, what Murrow said, what Paley said, because who knows what the truth is. Shire lost his sponsor, And Shirer maintained it was because of his liberal views. And
you mean his advertising sponsor for his show?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Murrow said no. It was declining ratings. Murrow was Shirer's boss at that
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
And so who knows? Except that the tragedy is these two pals were only barely civil to each other the rest of their lives, and it's a shame because they shared that bond of starting a network news operation and the bond you get from being in a war with somebody, and the reporters were just as much in the war as anyone else.
But that bitterness stayed right until the end of Murrow's life, at his death at 57 in what was it, 1965?
Well, even the end of Shirer's life, which was a very long one, but even after Murrow was gone, he was still blaming Murrow for ruining his radio career.
But the bigger falling out with CBS itself.
Yes, and he and Paley were very close, Murrow and Paley,
mm-hmm.
and during the war. But CBS changed after the war. CBS got bigger. It was in television and had a record label and a studio and real estate and lots of other holdings. And Murrow's programs were bad for business.
Because?
Bad for the bottom line, because they were controversial. Sponsors didn't like them. Sponsors want, you know, light entertainment to be able to sell their products. Controversy doesn't sell products. Controversy puts their product, their company's name up with a program that a whole lot of people wouldn't like because it's controversial. The FCC didn't care for these programs. They upset some members of Congress. Paley didn't like any of that. He liked big ratings and money-making programs. And see it now, Murrow's program was neither highly rated nor made money. It just caused trouble for the bottom line.
You write that Ed Murrow could not function in today's journalism. Why? Same reason?
Yes. I think his journalism was a bit more subjective than what we're used to. You know, it came to a point, and if you listen to the end of his McCarthy broadcast, for example, what you get there is a civics lesson. It's a commentary, and wouldn't be allowed today. I don't think he could function unless he was the boss. He would have to have his own channel, I think.
Well, and maybe he would, and maybe he wouldn't. Let's listen to that very broadcast you referred to, Bob Edwards, here from March 9th, 1954, on Edward R. Murrow's program, CBS program, See It Now. Here's Ed Murrow taking Joe McCarthy head-on with this stinging indictment for the senator in his closing commentary.
No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind as between the internal and the external threats of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men.
Edward R. Murrow taking on Joe McCarthy in March of 1954. Bob Edwards, in your long career, how close did you ever come to the tone and attitude of that piece we just heard?
Well, never. Never.
Because you were taught not to, because you didn't have it just wasn't your inclination, because it's out of fashion, because it's taboo.
All of the above. What Murrow was upset about was not the fact that, he might have been, but less so the fact that McCarthy was using the fear of the Soviet Union to advance his own political career. He was upset about the lack of due process, the protections in the Constitution that every witness before a committee should enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And what he showed on See It Now prior to this summary was McCarthy in action, badgering witnesses, bullying, showed the man for what he was, a demagogue. And that was what was so upsetting to Murrow.
And essentially, you write, Bob Edwards also showed how television could accomplish what print and maybe even radio could not, delivering the whole image of the man, and it was repugnant to many American viewers.
Yeah, you could read about this in the paper, but it didn't have the impact that it had when you saw it on television. It really showed the power of television that night, and there's never been anything quite like that ever again.
It's kind of the Abu Ghraib effect, at least, of images. Bob Edwards,
it was also the beginning of the end of Murrow, because thereafter, it's falling action. 2 years later, he lost his sponsor. 2 years after that, he lost his program.
And the beginning of the end of something of American journalism. And I want to come to that with you, but so many callers want to join this conversation. Bob, I'd like to turn to them if we can. Francis is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Francis. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
I don't really need to be on the air, but I do want NPR to know that they have shoved aside a very fine broadcaster in Bob Edwards, and I wish I could wake up to his voice each morning like I used to do. It's just not the same, and I miss him very much.
What is it about Bob Edwards that you miss, Francis?
His honesty and his caring about other people. It comes through very clearly. And I remember Edward R. Murrow, and I think he was great to tackle McCarthy. That was a good idea, even if it did cost him. People need to know the truth, and our best newscasters will tell us the truth even today. They may do it more gently. I was 8 years old when the war began, and my brothers went away. I remember my oldest brother saying, "I'll see you after the war." That was before we were actually involved, and he was sent to the Philippines. Mm. And we listened to the radio every night, Murrow and Thomas and Heater and others.
Yeah.
And we read the Bible and prayed every night. And that oldest brother that went to the Philippines was soon captured and held captive throughout the war. And in January 9, 1945, he was killed by friendly fire as he was being transported from the Philippines to the Japanese mainland on a Japanese cargo ship.
So you would be listening closely. Your family had a lot at stake.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. And lots of prayers, and many of them answered.
Francis, stand by. I want to get your fellow Kentuckian, Bob Edwards, in here with you. Bob, here's a listener who misses you, but is still confident that, as Francis says, our best newscasters will still tell us the truth, even if they do it gently. Do you agree on that front, Bob?
Well, I certainly hope so. we're not in the business to do anything less. That's our job. That's what we're supposed to do. And to ask the tough questions, a job that we haven't always done. Particularly last year, going into the war. I'm still very upset about that.
Well, isn't that a kind of object lesson or warning that Francis may not be right? We just went to war, as you say, and the truth was not necessarily told in advance.
Yeah. No, the questions weren't asked. You know, it's the job of the politician, the office holder, to tell the truth, but it's our job to get him to do that, and I don't think we did it. I think we were following the polls. We were afraid to challenge authority. It was seen as unpatriotic. So I don't think we lied, or as Francis said, did not tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
We simply weren't aggressive about getting it out.
Yeah, and it didn't come out. The job the press needs to do is pretty obvious there. Francis, thanks for your call. I miss Bob Edwards in the morning, too. Kevin's calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. My question has to deal with the turning point that broadcast journalism represents, and if at all that it's possibly led to a professionalization of journalism in a way that it's turned politics into horse race coverage, and by doing so has cultivated the cynicism in the populace about the possibilities of their using the levers of, you know, democratic governance. The idea of the 19th century being, you know, print journalism being highly partisan, and the assumption being that partisanship is inseparable at times from truth-telling.
Are you saying you'd like to see a more partisan press than Kevin, or not?
Well, I mean, I think maybe you two could possibly answer that more likely, but I think the advent of broadcast journalism, in the progressive era, there was the idea of the professionalization of journalism and objectivity, and I think they reported events and the text of speeches and so forth. With the advent of broadcast journalism, the possibilities of the print media dealing with the immediacy of the event was no longer tenable because it couldn't compete with the immediacy of broadcast.
So something else happened there. Let us pick that up, Kevin. Thanks for your call. Bob Edwards, how about it? Professionalism over time bleeding truth out of journalism. Kevin's asking for a dash maybe even of partisanship to pump it up.
I wonder if that's where we're going. I mean, you see Fox News, for example, and you see Air America.
Mm-hmm.
Do people want a partisan press? We had it once. The country started with a partisan press. Europe's very comfortable with it. You know, you have your Christian Democrat paper, and you have your labor paper, your socialist paper. And maybe that's where people want to go. They want their views, their biases affirmed. In some way by, Rush or whomever they're listening to or reading or watching. I don't know. I'm uncomfortable with that. I don't think I could do that. I can't follow a doctrine all the way, you know.
But is there a middle ground here? You write, Bob Edwards, that Edward R. Murrow's style was too bold for public broadcasting, whose executives have to face government scrutiny. And I hear you scolding a little bit, timidity. In the world that you work in, and so do I, public radio, for being perhaps too careful in its reporting, too careful to be balanced, maybe even at the expense of truth.
Well, no, I think when I'm doing a news program, I'm very comfortable with that. When I'm out here just mouthing off, I'm some other person. You know, I'm not at a new. I'm not doing the news right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm at a greater liberty, perhaps, to tell you how I feel.
But you write, for example, about Bill Moyers. You note that he ends his PBS program now with commentary. That he does so, you say, is considered audacious by those who want public broadcasting to be as bland as an actuarial table. That doesn't sound like an endorsement.
Yeah, he catches a lot of flack for that. There are a lot of people, both in public broadcasting and outside public broadcasting, who think that Bill Moyers should not be doing that commentary. And to me, he is the closest thing we have to the style of broadcasting that Murrow did so long ago.
Do you think he should be doing that kind of commentary or not?
I can take that from Bill Moyers, but not everybody is Bill Moyers.
Yeah,
see, I do it person by person. You know, I'm fine with Moyers doing it. I wouldn't be so fine with me doing it.
Bob Edwards, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with longtime NPR Morning Edition host Bob Edwards. His new book is Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. You can join our conversation. What's your question for an NPR original? Are you getting what you want and what you need from public radio news? And what's the Bob Edwards moment that sticks with you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Bob Edwards about broadcast news legend Edward R. Murrow, and with Bob Edwards about Bob Edwards and NPR. His new book is Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. You can join our conversation tonight. What's your question for the host of NPR's Morning Edition for 24 years and 6 months, Bob Edwards? And where do you hear the spirit of Edward R. Murrow moving in American journalism today? Do you hear it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. It's actually Lexington, Massachusetts. But
okay, Lexington. Great. Good to have you.
And my question is for Bob, since you're willing to mouth off a bit here, if you'd like to this opportunity to describe your falling out with NPR, if you want to call it that, and if you felt any, not that they're identical situations, of course, but any parallel feelings of your Edward R. Murrow's falling out with CBS. And then just since you asked, Tom, the thing I remember Bob most is probably his conversations with Red Barber.
Yeah.
And that's certainly some of my fondest memories of the morning edition.
Those were terrific, terrific for all of us to listen to. But Bob Edwards, how about it? Go straight at it. David wants to know why the falling out. Do you see parallels with Ed Murrow's falling out?
No parallel at all. Murrow was losing money for the network with See It Now and costing them money. I have been raising money.
You're the number one morning show on radio, 13 million listeners, and yes, raising money.
So we're just the opposite.
But that's only the financial side of it. How do you understand, or to yourself at this point, a month or two after it first came up, what happened with Morning Edition, Bob? You said at the time in March when it first came out, I would have loved to stay with Morning Edition, but it's not my candy store. How have you processed the whole departure and shift change?
They want new hosts. That's all. I'm not the first, and maybe I won't be the last. But they want to keep us on the network, but not hosting programs. They want new hosts, and that's that. That's how I see it.
Do you think it was a good decision?
Are you
bitter? Do you miss it? What are your feelings about it?
Well, clearly, it's not the decision I would have made, is it? But. It's their network. They're in charge, and I'm not.
And what is the vision of NPR that this change was part of moving toward, or supposed to be part of moving toward?
Well, let's see. They have said refreshing the program, meeting the changing needs of listeners, part of the natural evolution. So I take them at their word.
Refreshment. Well, you're still a pretty refreshing guy, Bob. I'm sure we'll have more questions on that, so I'll leave it at that for the moment. David, thanks for your call. Barbara's calling from Ellison Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, sure.
I haven't called radio programs very often, but I think it's an opportunity to thank Bob Edwards tremendously for the work that he's done over the years.
Amen.
And I miss your voice on Morning Edition. And I am an NPR devotee. I heard you announce it back, you know, some months ago, whenever it happened. And you were very gracious and everything. And I thought, oh, it has to do with, you know, youth or whatever. I don't know. But I think it's a mistake. But I wanted to say that I have memories of Edward R. Murrow. I'm not old enough to remember the war. But what I do remember is his program on migrant workers. Program or programs. I'm not sure if it was a series.
Any idea what year that would have been, Barbara?
Oh, I don't know. It seems to me I would still have been a teenager, perhaps.
1960.
60.
60?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Then I probably was still in high school.
Okay. People forget how long he was around through Sputnik and Castro's rise. And what was it about that show?
Oh, my. Well, I suppose in high school I was introduced somewhat to the problems of migrant workers and the poverty and so on. And I think that show just drove it home, how tremendously difficult a life that was and how people had suffered. And Murrow's, compassion for people.
It was called Harvest of Shame. It was part of the series.
Yes. I mean, this is
CBS
a long
reports.
Time ago now, but he was, it just stuck in my mind and stayed there.
Bob, what was the form of that show? What was the impact of it?
It was produced by David Loeb. Murrow gets a lot of credit for it. He did assist in the writing. He did go down to Florida and personally see the situation of migrant workers there. It had an enormous impact, and it's been updated by CBS, by public television, by NBC, And the interesting thing about the updates is that there's nothing to update. It's pretty much the same situation for migrant workers today. It's still horribly difficult work in the hot sun by the most exploitable group of workers that we have.
And what was it about Ed Murrow's reporting on a subject like that that gave it such impact? Was it because he would come in first or something about his delivery?
I think most people had no idea how food got on their table. They knew that on some level there was a farmer somewhere, obviously, but the fact that that these workers in these conditions are made to work this way for little protection, and I think the United Farm Workers definitely came out of that program in 1960. It was one of the last things Murrow did before he left to go off and join the brand-new Kennedy administration.
Just tearing the curtains off that with David Loeb's help. Barbara, thanks very much for your call. Peter's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
One quick comment I want to make before I get on the main issue is that when I heard Bob Edwards talk about the reasons for his getting replaced, he really didn't say anything. And of course, he doesn't know, maybe doesn't know any more than what he's already told us, but I think he said it referred to as their network. No, this is our network. We pay for you guys. We pay for it with your contributions, and I demand, as I'm sure many of us do, what do they mean? Refreshing change. And I would like to see this posted on your website as to what NPR's official non-committal I don't want this.
Well, NPR did, I guess, put a big explanation up on its website, whether it's satisfying or not.
I mean, I think the thing is that it really never gets to the real point of where they're going. And I think what they should do is define what it is, where they're going, what direction they need to take to replace somebody. I think that's the first point. The second is a question to Bob Edwards. And I'm wondering if the lack of investigative journalism, rather than just reporting the car accident at the intersection where you hear all over NPR, you'll hear something about Iraq on a specific issue, then you'll have talk shows all about that thing after it's happened, rather than trying to bring perspective into the world and try to make sense before things happening. I mean, an example would be this obesity issue could have been looked into 10, 15 years ago in terms of the trend. And that would have made a significant difference to the listeners. And I think maybe part of this is that back in World War I and II, we used to, sacrifice. We used to, save tin and not hoard gasoline. And today we have to drive our SUVs instead of, the rich in World War I and II said, we want to contribute more of our taxes. And today we want our taxes cut. And I think it's all about me, and if you cannot relate something to me quickly, then it isn't news worthy of garnering a lot of interest. And I think the only place where that is maybe this advance notice of something might be 60 Minutes, as an example.
In other words, dig in aggressively early, don't wait for it to come late, and then just talk it to death.
Reporting the car accident. I mean, what we need to do is how to avoid one in our world.
Peter, you've put a lot on the table there. Let us pick it up, and thanks for that. Bob Edwards, you do say that 60 Minutes, by your lights, may be the most direct successor of the Ed Murrow impulse.
Don Hewitt, the executive producer and founder, creator of 60 Minutes, was the studio director for See It Now under Murrow, and always said that he chose as his format for 60 Minutes, High Murrow and Low Murrow. High Murrow being 60 Minutes, a no-nonsense, straight news program, and Low Murrow being person-to-person. This is something we haven't talked about.
More
did celebrity interviews. He did a program called Person to Person, which was pure pap, made no pretense at news, and was there to this is a program that actually made money for CBS and was a big rating success. Made money for Murrow because he owned a piece of it and later owned all of it and sold it to William Paley.
Did he see a conflict between those two things?
No, not at all. He hoped that Person to Person would bring in a wider audience for See It Now. But his friends just really got on his case about doing it. Why are you doing that program, Ed.
But what about Peter's deeper point that there's something in the kind of pitch of the American character today that may resist looking into difficult stories, not only in the media, but even beyond the media?
Well, I think we've been doing that. I honestly do. I always thought the strong suit of NPR was to explain things, to do the background, to, provide in-depth coverage. Although now the stated mission is going more towards breaking news. I don't know how our last caller would feel about that. I've always thought that we did do the background, that was our strength.
Can NPR have it both ways? This American Journalism Review had a big article. You probably saw it. The headline, Quicker and Deeper, summarizing where NPR is trying to head now. Can NPR be a more CNN-style, quick delivery of breaking news service and at the same time go deep, Bob Edwards?
Excuse me. I'm very sorry. I don't know why not. We have so many programs now that there ought to be room for both. I hope that we don't abandon what I feel has been our strength, which is the in-depth reports, the explaining of news. I want something explained to me. I certainly want the headlines too, but I always felt we were doing that anyway. I've updated Morning Edition for 24 and a half years. Just about every day we make big changes in the program as it runs through the morning. So I don't know how much more emphasis we could put on breaking news.
Let's try and get one more call. Larry's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I want to relate, first of all, my most vivid memory of a morning show, which I think actually is a series, Bob, that you hosted back sometime around 1990-91, where you were in regular conversation with a brilliant and passionate and insightful reporter who reported to us on the events in South Africa at a very dark period of that time. I'm ashamed to say that I've forgotten the man's name.
Do you remember that, Bob?
Yeah, I do, and I'm blanking on the name too.
At any rate, not just to put this in the area of reminiscence, what makes those broadcasts live so much in my memory was the moral vitality of this man's report and the intensity of your commitment to that vitality without editorializing, as Murrow sometimes would do, as you pointed out earlier, the commitment to bringing this kind of intense moral vision in an area of deep concern to the mind and ears of the American public represented, I think, a tremendous service. And
Larry, that's very well said. I've only got another minute here, so I'm going to have to let you go. But let's get Bob Edwards' response. Bob, have you still got that intensity of commitment? Is NPR still the venue for delivering it?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I think we are the heir to Murrow. Dan Shore has said that, and Murrow hired Dan Shore. My journalism professor, who also was a writer for Murrow, said that. The late Fred Friendly told me that, too. So I hope he would be proud of what we're doing.
Bob Edwards, we can't thank you enough for all your years in the morning, and we look forward to your work in all the rest of the day. And thanks so much for being with us tonight. Thanks for the new book.
Well, you're very welcome.
Bob Edwards, longtime host of NPR's Morning Edition, author of Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.